sketches of the role played by women in the Reformation. The first one I took was Catherine von Bora, Luther's wife, whose sphere was in establishing the first important Protestant parsonage. Then I took Catherine Sell, called the mother of the Reformation in Strasbourg. She had only two children who died in infancy and then no more, and she devoted herself to all manner of public works and assistance to her husband. Then Vibrandus Rosenblatt, who was married four times, and the last three husbands were all prominent reformers, Ecolampadius, the reformer at Basel, Capito at Strasbourg, and Bucer also at Strasbourg, and Bucer's exile to England she shared. We looked last time at the women of the Anabaptists. We do not know enough in this case to present a full-length study of any one. I gave a rather composite picture of these women who were subjected to the fiercest of persecution and whose groups have survived only by migrating to the fringes of Europe and then to the frontiers of North and of South America. In that case, we discovered that union in the faith brought couples more closely together, and disagreement with regard to the faith was a very great strain on marital relations. There are some most amazing examples of constancy under persecution. Now tonight I want to take two women, mother and daughter, the first briefly, the other more extensively, who were both involved in political life because one was the Electress of Brandenburg and the other was the Duchess of Braunschweig, in English commonly called Brunswick. This story is quite complicated, and I welcome an opportunity of inflicting it upon you to see whether you can tell how it all holds together. It is complicated because the political life of Germany was highly complicated. We have to deal with the empire, which still had a strong measure of authority, though it had been weakened since the Middle Ages. The emperor was Charles V of Spain, of the House of Habsburg, who by native right had also control over Austria and over the Netherlands. He was endeavoring to reconstitute a political Europe, to bring back again the empire of a Charlemagne, and he was very strongly Catholic. In his endeavors at centralization, he was resisted by the local princes in Germany. There were a great many of them, and Germany was never really united until Bismarck and finally Hitler. These territorial princes were all nibbling away at the authority of the emperor, though they owed and admitted a vassalage relationship to him. The princes were all trying to consolidate authority within their own territories, and they in turn were resisted frequently by the nobility and by the peasants. So that centralization and decentralization were in tension, as indeed they had been throughout the Middle Ages, but now even more acutely. Another factor which complicated the situation was the unfortunate practice of dividing up territory between the sons of rulers, so that some sections of Germany came to be exceedingly fragmented. Take, for example, Saxony, Luther's country. This had been divided between two sons, Ernest and Albert. And Ernestine Saxony, in which Luther lived, had the dignity of the electorate. That is to say, the ruler of that territory was one of those who elected the emperor. The other section was called ducal, because the ruler was only a duke. Well, ducal Saxony simply cut electoral Saxony right down the middle, just like the Polish corridor. Now, the woman to whom I shall devote most attention tonight was in Brunswick or Braunschweig, and this had been all cut up by that process. There was Braunschweig Lüneburg, Braunschweig Kallenberg, Braunschweig Münden, and Braunschweig Wolfenbüttel. All of these various divisions. Now Hanover and Göttingen belonged to Kallenberg, but Braunschweig and Wolfenbüttel and Goslar belonged to Wolfenbüttel. They'd all been united at one time and now split up by these various divisions. To increase the complication, there were all manner of political marriages. The emperor married off his sisters to various princes, and all of the rest of the dukes and the duchesses proceeded in similar fashion. Marriages were made without regard to the taste of those involved, and little respect with regard to their ages. One of the women we're about to consider was 40 years younger than her husband, and she married her daughter just to a man who was 40 years older than she. These were political marriages, not based on affection or even previous acquaintance. And frequently the result of that was that the man had affairs on the outside and that they were practically taken for granted. Now this whole story would be a little easier to follow if one had maps and if one had genealogies, but I'll endeavor by motions to indicate where things were. Suppose this is the Atlantic Ocean off here. Then in about the middle of Germany, up on the North Sea, you have Bremen, and you come down south from that, and you'll come to Hanover and Göttingen, and these are all in Braunschweig-Kallenberg. You go a little farther south from that, and you run into Hesse, a strongly Lutheran territory. Then you go over toward the east, and up north you've got Brandenburg and Berlin, and down below that you have the two Saxonies. You move still farther east and you'll come to the Polish corridor. And then you go beyond that and you come to East Prussia. And it rather amazed me that the German ruler of East Prussia also sat in the Polish Diet. So intimate were all of these interrelations. Now I'll come to these two women. And briefly first with regard to Elizabeth of Brandenburg. She was married to Joachim I, the Elector of Brandenburg, and she was a Danish princess. She was the daughter of the King of Denmark, but she was the niece of Frederick the Wise and John, Luther's princes. Their sister Christine had been married to the King of Denmark. So here is at least a half a Danish princess married to Joachim I, the Elector of Brandenburg. Now, Joachim I was a very ardent Catholic. He was so ardent that he argued that Luther's safe conduct to the Diet of Worms should not be respected. And all along the line, he was vehemently opposing any introduction of Lutheranism into his territory. Well, his wife, who was very much his junior, at first, showed no inclinations to Lutheranism, and when her brother-in-law, Albert of Mainz, the great cardinal against whom Luther directed his theses, he was the brother of Joachim of Brandenburg, when Albert sent her a piece of the true cross, she wrote and said, "I thank you profoundly for this holy relic of the true cross. I will treat it with the utmost veneration. By the way, could you let us have a flask of Rhenish wine?" So her piety may not have been very deep, but at any rate, she was very devout and showed no Protestant inclinations. But by and by, the Lutheran anopheles began to bite people even in the area of Brandenburg. Traveling preachers came in, disseminating Luther's scriptures and singing Luther's hymns. Joachim put out an edict against any singing of these heretical hymns. He got a committee to investigate Luther's Bible, found 100 errors, and forbade the circulation of Luther's Bible. But somehow or other, his wife began to hear about the Lutheran teaching, and it may have come in part from her brother, the King of Denmark, who was exiled. Now his wife, and this is another curious mix-up, was the sister of the very Catholic Emperor Charles. Her name was Isabella. But she had embraced Lutheranism, and it may be through them, who were now traveling around in exile, that Elizabeth of Brandenburg learned of the Lutheran teaching. And when her husband was away from home, she received communion in both kinds, the wine as well as the bread, from a Lutheran minister. Well, when he got back and found out what she'd done, he put the case before a committee of theologians who said they thought the death penalty would be too severe. They thought that divorce would be admissible but not advisable, and they would suggest that she be incarcerated for life. Well, her husband didn't want to be too unreasonable. He gave her about a year to make up her mind. By next Easter, she'd got to have it settled. Well, fearing incarceration for life, she took the case up with her uncle, John of Saxony. He was the brother of Frederick the Wise, and he was now the ruler there. Frederick the Wise was dead. Well, he advised her to run away and come to Saxony, and he would give her asylum. And her brother, the exiled king of Sweden, Christian II, was ready to help her. So when her husband was away again, with connivance, with the custodian of the castle, she was let out through the gate that led to the moat, got into a little boat, went down the moat beyond the cemetery, was picked up there by a carriage provided by her brother, the king of Sweden, and succeeded in making her escape into Saxony. There was a frightful uproar over it. The emperor demanded that she go back. Her husband demanded that she go back, but go back she would not. But no money was allowed to be sent to her, and in a good deal of poverty for some years. She lived now in one place, now in another in Saxony. She left behind her, by the way, two daughters and two sons. They smuggled through a little money to her occasionally, but the sons were not allowed to come and visit her. Then she broke down in mind for a while, and she was housed with the Luthers, another job for Luther and for Katie. She got very difficult. Luther wrote to the elector John and said, "For heaven's sake, get her out of here." He said, "I just can't stand her." He said, "She acts like a child. She comes barging into the room, even into the bedroom." And he said, "Her sons did get a little money through to her, and now she's giving it away lavishly. She's given me 100 gulden. I can't possibly accept it. And now that I have refused, she's sulking. I do hope you can get her out of here." Well, the elector fixed up a castle for her at Liechtenstein. They moved her over there. And Luther went to see her. Her mind was pretty well restored by that time. They had supper together. She said, "Lieber Herr Doktor, I hope you live for another 40 years. "Good God," he said, "if God offered me paradise on condition that I stay down here for another 40 years, I'd turn it down and call for the executioner to cut off my head." Well, he had to stay down here for about another 6 years. Well, her husband died. Then her sons begged her to come home, but they were still Catholic. No, she wouldn't come. But in 1539, it was in 1535, her husband died. In 39, 4 years later, both of her sons became Lutheran. Then they invited her back. She said, "Well, exactly what kind of Lutheranism?" She found that they were still observing certain popish ceremonies, and they were having parades on some of the Catholic holy days. No, she wouldn't come. Well, Luther was asked what he thought about it. He said, "Well, if the elector wants to put on a robe in a procession, let him put on 3 like Aaron. If he wants to dance before the ark, let him dance like David. If he wants bugles, let him blow like Joshua around Jericho. These are not the essentials." But she was more strict than Luther. She was really a proto-Puritan, anticipating the rigidities of the Puritan Reformation. Finally, one of her sons came with 500 horsemen to get her. Well, it's a little hard to resist 500 horsemen. So she consented to go back. And they set her up with a little estate of her own at Spandau. Spandau in the war was a big prison camp, and all it's famous for now is that Rudolf Hess is still imprisoned there. But Spandau was an attractive place at that time. They set her up there, and there she conducted Lutheran services with no popish ceremonies. When she was desperately ill, she asked to be transferred from Spandau to Berlin proper, and her son Joachim II said he'd try to arrange it. One wonders why, when she was dying, it mattered where she died. But when one examines her will, one understands the reason why. She wanted to die and be buried next to the husband whom she had deserted 27 years before for the sake of religion. Well, now, as I say, her two sons both became Lutheran, and Joachim II was the elector, and a little territory was given to the other brother, John. But now one of the daughters was married to Eric of Brunswick, and he was 40 years older than she. He was Catholic, she was too, This was before her mother became Lutheran, for that matter, and she didn't become Lutheran as speedily as her mother. But when she went to Braunschweig, Lutheran ministers began to infiltrate. And very shortly, she learned that her two brothers had gone Lutheran. And one of those brothers came to see her. And he laid before her the case for Lutheranism and suggested that she invite a Lutheran minister. So she sent down to the south to Hesse, which is down below Braunschweig, and asked Philip of Hesse, who was the great political leader of the Protestants, if he couldn't send her a minister. He sent her one named Corvinus, C-O-R-V-I-N-U-S. He came up and preached in her private chapel, dedicated a book to her. We've got a copy of it in the Yale Library. It's a beautiful little publication. And she was so affected by this that she received communion in both kinds. Well, this came to the ear of her husband. He wasn't like her father. Old Eric said, if she doesn't interfere with my religion, I won't interfere with hers. But he says, as for me, I'm too old to grub around and find out what's true and what's false, and I'm going to stay by the religion I was baptized in, the religion of the emperor whom I am bound to obey. And so he thought they could leave it at that, with a mutual tolerance. But he didn't know what he was tolerating, because Elizabeth was an ardent proselytizer. She wasn't content just to have communion in both kinds for herself. Now, she had a territory over which she was practically the ruler. It was called in German a Leibzucht, and in English, I suppose we'd call it a widow's dower. It was a territory which was given to the wife of a ruler, the income of which was guaranteed to her if she became a widow until her death. And in that little area, it wasn't too big, she was the practical ruler. Münden, M-U-E-N-D-E-N, was the title of that little territory. Well, she was a very practical administrator. She was already running everything in Münden. And she was determined that she'd Lutheranize all of her little district. So she was very busily engaged in this process of propaganda. Well, that put her husband in rather an embarrassing position, because the emperor was a very stoutly Catholic. And if Eric were to allow his territory in this fashion to be evangelized, what then might happen? He himself hadn't been too strong for Catholicism, because he had allowed Lutheranism a little earlier to be introduced in Göttingen and Hanover, because those two cities paid an enormous sum into his depleted treasury. They practically bribed him to let them be Lutheran. So he'd given way on that. Two cities were Lutheran. But now she, with the aid of this minister Corvinus, began evangelizing the countryside. Pretty dangerous thing to do, because the people felt so intensely about it that they might have murdered a Lutheran evangelist. But she went around with him herself evangelizing the countryside. So now Göttingen and Hanover had gone over, and this territory of Münden was beginning to move over. And what then was going to happen? Well, it wasn't just the emperor that her husband would have to think about. It was the ruler of the neighboring section of Braunschweig, namely Wolfenbüttel. Now, these territories, Kahlenberg with Göttingen in it and Hanover, and Wolfenbüttel with Braunschweig and Wolfenbüttel and Goslar, had once been united. Then they were divided between sons, and this was a very difficult situation, because they had mining rights that overlapped and hunting rights that overlapped, and there were abbacies and there were monasteries and all the rest of it which had overlapping jurisdictions. Therefore, the ruler of Wolfenbüttel was always trying to get back control over Kahlenberg, or at least to dictate to it, and the ruler of Kahlenberg was trying to do the same thing for Wolfenbüttel. Now, the ruler of Wolfenbüttel was Heinz. Since he ruled in Wolfenbüttel, they called him the Wolf, Heinz the Wolf. Now, Heinz the Wolf was a pretty tough man. He kept his brother in prison for 11 years because he would not recognize the principle of primogeniture. The father of these boys had decided he wouldn't divide up the territory anymore, and he wouldn't give any to the brother. And the brother was ready to start a war to get it, to get his share of it. But Heinz kept him in jail for 11 years until he finally gave in. One can see the temper of Heinz from another point. He had a concubine, Eva von Trott, with whom he was very much in love. Well, his wife didn't quite like the idea. And some other people criticized him. So he announced that Eva was very sick. Then he announced that she was dead. They had a magnificent funeral for her, with masses for her departed spirit, while in the meantime her body departed for a distant castle where she continued to bear more children to her enamored lover. Evidently his Catholicism did not sit very deeply from a religious point of view, but from a political point of view it did. He wasn't going to upset all of the abbacies and all of the bishoprics and the ecclesiastical territories in his area, and he wasn't going to come out and disobey the emperor over a matter of religion. And he was determined, if he possibly could, to get control over the territory of Kahlenberg. Well, Heinz became the implacable foe of Elizabeth. So she began to look around to see what political alliances she could make to strengthen her hand. And she thought the best thing to do was to get her children properly married. She had four of them. There was one boy named Eric. He was to be Eric II. She thought of marrying him to the daughter of Philip of Hesse, that Protestant prince. That would strongly strengthen her hand. But before anything could be arranged, her husband, 40 years her senior, sensed that for him the end was coming. After he died, what then? If he died right away, his son would be only 11 years old. They'd have to have a regent. Well, Heinz of Wolfenbüttel was quite ready to be regent. But Eric was not going to let Heinz get it. He appointed his wife as the regent. But then she, being a woman, would have to have a guardian. And Heinz of Wolfenbüttel was quite ready to be her guardian. And it didn't seem quite discreet to refuse him on everything. So Eric I agreed that Heinz of Wolfenbüttel should be one guardian. Then he decided she better have some more guardians. So, to check him, he appointed Philip of Hesse as a guardian. So now she had two guardians, one who was determined to be a Catholic and get control of her territory, and the other was a staunch Lutheran. And as a matter of fact, Philip of Hesse and Heinz had had a war over religion before this. Philip heard that Heinz was forming a league of Catholic princes to suppress Lutheranism. So he intercepted a messenger on horseback of Heinz, rifled his saddlebags, found proof of the suspicion, thereupon fell on Wolfenbüttel and captured Heinz and kept him in prison for 2 years, then let him out. Well, now putting Philip of Hesse and Heinz together as guardians was like yoking the wolf with the lion's whelp. Well, Eric realized this might make trouble, so he decided to have a third guardian. And he appointed Elizabeth's brother, Joachim II, the Elector of Brandenburg. Well, now he had it all set up. He was all ready to die. She should be regent, and these three should try to keep the balance. There was a Diet of the Empire meeting at Hagenau in 1540. He went down to confront the emperor. And he did so with no little nervousness. He arrived in Hagenau, and there he died. and his coffers were so depleted that there wasn't enough money to bring his body back to Braunschweig for burial. It had to lie in state for a whole year, and you can imagine what kind of a state. Well, this made Elizabeth the regent of Braunschweig for her son, Eric, who by this time was 12 years old. And what an administrator she was. There's one whole fat volume today giving all the data on her administration, all of the finances, all of the assistance. She had a whole household of about 200 to feed, who were in charge of all the administration. We've got a complete record listing in full the data on finance, justice, jewels, edibles, livestock, oxen, sheep, rabbits, hens, geese, bacon, cheese, butter, wine, and beer. And she kept an oversight over the whole thing. But her greatest concern was now to spread Lutheranism throughout the entire territory. So now, with the aid of this minister, Corvinus, she drew up a new liturgy, a hymn book, and an ordinance regulating all the ecclesiastical affairs. It was not to be too rigorous on the Catholics. The cloisters did not have to be discontinued. The inmates who so chose might stay, though those who elected to remain should be free at any time to leave. In the meantime, they should discard their religious habits, wear ordinary dark clothes and underwear like that of any other Christian. Corvinus and Elizabeth then began to visit all the churches and vehemently to introduce the reform. But nothing was more important to Elizabeth than to train her son so that he might carry on. She was delighted when she saw him with the other boys in church singing antiphonally with the congregation. He was thoroughly grounded in the catechism. And the most important thing to do would be to get him married properly. Well, she thought of marrying him with the daughter of Philip of Hesse. But Philip of Hesse had rather compromised himself lately. He'd had a political marriage with a wife to whom he was not attracted and had been guilty of promiscuity. It didn't bother him while he was a Catholic, but after he became a Lutheran, his conscience troubled him and he didn't feel right about going to the Lord's Supper. So he suggested to Luther and the other theologians that if he could have one wife whom he loved, he could behave himself. Well, Luther said that bigamy wasn't forbidden in the Old Testament, and certainly, although it wasn't ideal, it would be better than promiscuity, and in the form of conscience it could be justified, but it was contrary to the law of the land and therefore should be kept secret. Well, now, if it were kept secret, the extra wife would look like a concubine and nobody would say anything. It was all right to have a concubine, but not to have another wife. But Philip wasn't satisfied with that. He announced it. Whereupon, to make his peace with the emperor, he had to withdraw from his leadership of the political union of the Protestant princes. So his daughter wouldn't be quite so good for young Eric under those circumstances. So she turned farther east to Saxony. Well, there was a Saxon prince named Moritz, M-O-R-I-T-Z, and he was a strong Lutheran. He had a sister, her name was Sidonia. She was the one. So Elizabeth took her son Eric, who was only about 16 then, all the way from Braunschweig over to Saxony to see Sidonia. They stopped in Wittenberg and called on Luther, and he examined young Eric on the catechism, found that he was thoroughly orthodox. But Luther wrote to this minister, Corvinus said, "I hope he won't succumb to the pressures which are brought to bear upon princes." The young man was introduced to Sidonia, and it was arranged that in due time he would marry her, though the marriage did not take place quite immediately. Well, as the time approached when Eric would be 17 and would take over, Elizabeth wrote for him a treatise on government, a very good one too, a lot of political wisdom in it, concluding with the exhortation to obey God, the emperor, and your mother. Well, apparently it never occurred to her there could be any conflict between God and his mother. She didn't realize there was going to be one with the emperor. Well, when Eric reached his majority and became Eric II, she acted as if she were going to withdraw from the administration and leave it to him. She got married again to a good Lutheran prince, a rather small one, Popel of Henneberg. Well, if she did that, it would seem appropriate that she should give up her widow's dower in that little principality at Minden. She wasn't a widow now. But she was determined she wasn't going to give it up because she wasn't sure how much of an administrator Eric would be, and she didn't want to take her hands off things. Well, Popo suggested that she sell it for a monetary consideration and come and buy a widow's dower in his territory. She wouldn't give it up. Well, this doesn't disrupt their marriage, but they did have a difference of opinion about it. She was going to keep her finger on things. She also desired to strengthen her position by getting her daughters properly married. And one of them, Anna Maria, was only 18. But now, Albert of Prussia, East Prussia, way over beyond the Polish corridor, had lost his wife, a Danish princess whom he had loved very greatly. And he was 40 years older than Anna, and he didn't intend to marry at all, but he didn't have a son. And it was very important to have an heir. So Elizabeth took the initiative and told him that he ought to take her daughter in order to provide for the succession. Well, he decided probably he should. And he was a good, strong Lutheran. And Anna trusted her daughter to be Lutheran. So it was arranged that they should marry. Well, Elizabeth would like to go to East Prussia for the wedding, but she felt she was needed at home to keep an eye on Eric. So her husband agreed to be chaperone. Little did he know that he wouldn't get back for 4 years. Well, in the meantime, Eric began to assert his independence. There was a diet of the empire, a meeting at Regensburg in 1546. He was only 18. He was very much flattered that he was now one of the princes of the realm and would sit with all of the great dignitaries. His mother was very much worried about having him go to the diet. He was afraid that the Catholic emperor would get hold of him and pull him around to his side. Before he left, she had the Lord's Supper with him, the bread and the wine, and had him swear that he would not forsake the true faith. And he told the minister, Corvinus, that whatever he had in his breast, he would stake for the Reformed religion. When he repeated that to another, he replied a bit vulgarly, "Perhaps me lord had a snot rag in his vest that he was swearing on." Well, the fears were abundantly realized. Young Eric was taken into the imperial camp. It's quite possible that the emperor offered him advantages over Heinz the Wolf if he would come over. Now, the emperor had just reached the point where he had the power to crush Lutheranism. I mentioned that in connection with some of these other biographies. He had come up with Spanish troops. He offered the Lutherans a few slight concessions. They could have communion in both kinds, and clergy already married could have their status legalized, but no more could marry, and for the rest it had got to be Catholicism. He was ready to enforce this provision. And he proposed to impose it upon Germany. It was called the Augsburg Interim because this arrangement was to last in the interim until the meeting of a general council of the church. There was furious objection to it. Göttingen would not comply. Hanover would not comply. Braunschweig would not comply. Magdeburg would not comply. John Frederick of Saxony would not comply, and Philip of Hesse, though he had had his wings clipped, had grown his feathers again and joined the Protestant League, and he was ready to defy the emperor. A whole group of Protestant princes were ready to disrupt the structure of the Holy Roman Empire in the name of religion. But curiously, there was one Lutheran prince who didn't line up with the others, and that was Moritz. He was the brother-in-law of Eric, the brother of that Sidonia to whom Eric was now married, because he had two objectives. One was to reunite Saxony.